of America.
This is VOA News, coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. This weekend, the United States and many places around the world are witnessing more street marches in support of racial justice. All of this in the wake of George Floyd's killing at the hands of police in Minneapolis almost 2 weeks ago. In North Carolina, where the 46-year-old Floyd was born, there was a private service scheduled for today for the family. Burial will take place in Texas, where George Floyd spent most of his life. Large crowds in Washington are building for what's expected to be a massive demonstration against police brutality. Meanwhile, it was another relatively quiet night in cities across the U.S., which had been torn by violence for a week. The unrest followed George Floyd's death after a police officer pinned him down in the street with a knee on his neck for almost 9 minutes. The fired officer, Derek Chauvin, is charged with murder. Three other former officers are charged with aiding and abetting him. All four are in jail. Mainly peaceful Black Lives Matter protests in Australia took place today as thousands of demonstrators in state capitals honored the memory of George Floyd and protested the deaths of Indigenous Australians in police custody. Organizers of the Sydney march got a late reprieve when their appeal against a Friday ruling declaring the rally unauthorized was granted. The New South Wales Court of Appeal gave the green light just 12 minutes before the rally was scheduled to start. 30,000 people demonstrated in Brisbane, the capital of Queensland. In Paris, demonstrators tried to gather in front of the American embassy, defying restrictions tied to the pandemic. French authorities sealed off the building. In London, thousands of protesters ignored wet weather and a ban on large groups to crowd into Parliament Square. Wearing face masks amid the coronavirus threat and waving placards, some chanted, "No justice, no peace, no racist violence." In South Korea, there was a Black Lives Matter rally, the second in 2 days. More news online at voanews.com. For your listening convenience, there is also an easy-to-use mobile app. By remote, this is VOA News. City workers and volunteers in Washington, D.C. have painted Black Lives Matter in huge yellow lettering on a street leading to the White House. In the city of Denver, Colorado, police have been told to end their use of tear gas, plastic bullets, and other non-lethal force, such as flash grenades, against protesters. The temporary injunction was granted by a U.S. federal court judge in response to a lawsuit filed by demonstrators who complained about what they called excessive force used by officers during public demonstrations. The commissioner of the U.S. National Football League says the league was wrong for not listening to players fighting for racial equality. Roger Goodell, in a video, says, quote, "We believe Black Lives Matter. I personally protest with you and want to be part of the much-needed change in this country." Goodell added, "We in the National Football League condemn racism and the systematic oppression of black people. African-American NFL players caused a storm of controversy when many of them took a knee during the pregame playing of the U.S. national anthem to protest what they saw as abuses of police authority." The coronavirus pandemic continues its relentless assault. The latest figures, almost 6.8 million cases worldwide and more than 396,000 deaths. The United States has had 1.9 million infections with 109,000 lives lost. The numbers come from Johns Hopkins University. China is urging its citizens not to visit Australia, charging racial discrimination and violence against Asians. It appears to some to be Beijing's response to Australian government support for an investigation into the pandemic. China has effectively ended its imports of Australian barley by imposing tariffs and has banned the importation of Australian beef. China is Australia's number one customer for both. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi today announced a new peace initiative for Libya. Flanked by the war-torn nation's eastern commander, Khalifa Haftar, al-Sisi proposed an elected leadership council and a ceasefire starting on June 8th. Also on hand in Cairo was the eastern Libyan parliament head, Aguila Saleh. Reuters says the Egyptian plan includes a call for negotiations in Geneva and the departure of all foreign fighters from Libya. The country has been without a stable central authority since Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown by NATO-backed rebels in 2011. For more than 5 years, Libya has had rival governments in the east and the west, with streets often controlled by armed groups. Al-Sisi's announcement comes after the abrupt collapse of a 14-month offensive by Haftar's Libyan National Army. It was aimed at taking control of the capital, Tripoli. The U.S. Federal Reserve meets next week for the first time since April, when Fed Chair Jerome Powell said the U.S. economy could feel the weight of the economic shutdown for more than a year. More news online at voanews.com. Coming to you by remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
SEP normally is to organize another protestation, maybe next Friday.
Malian opposition and civil society groups demand the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita.
In Ghana, it's 100 Ghanaians. 100 Ghanaians is a lot of money for people living in remote areas and in areas where there are large unemployment and jobless people.
A leader of a Ghanaian opposition party rejects the Electoral Commission's plans to compile a new voter list to be used for the December polls.
It's the fact that we have to make them understand that the Sharia part of our constitution, there are clauses that are entrenched. And in the law part of our constitution, they are not entrenched.
And Christian groups in the Gambia seek protections in a new draft constitution. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Mali, opposition and civil society groups say they will continue with their protests next week if President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita refuses to step down. The protesters demonstrated in the capital Bamako Friday, demanding the president step down over what they say is growing insecurity and poor governance. It was led by Mahamad Diko, a prominent Muslim cleric and a former ally of the president. Meanwhile, Mali has welcomed news of the death of Abdelmalek Droukdel, chief of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. French troops with partners killed Droukdel and members of his inner circle in Mali's north following an operation launched on June 3. Niaga Diop, a young Malian political leader, tells me that opposition and civil society groups plan additional protests to pressure President Keita to step down.
I'm part of this group. So I'm a young political leader. So we organize the election about congressmen around 2 months. So after the elections, the result of the young candidates won. Really, but the constitutional court changed the result to give to some of the candidates of the majority, so for the ruling party. So this is the departure. This was the departure of the frustration of our people. The people say that this is abnormal to change the result of young people of Bama, of Komen, Sigaso, Gao, Umopti, and Kati. After that, they organized some protestation meeting to say we are not agree with the result of the constitutional court. So we have to give back our good result to be congressmen. This is the one reason of the resignation of the president we ask today. There is another reason. It is bad governance. This is another reason. There is another reason about the education. So long time the schools are closed, and there is problem of security.
Diaga, let me ask you, what has been the reaction of the government since you and your members and a lot of these political leaders demanded that the president resign? What has the government said about your resignation demand?
Officially, the government didn't make something, but the president of Congress make some actions to ask to the political leaders of Mahamud Diko and others to calm the situation, to find solution about all this crisis. Constitutional court, leading by Manasa, she makes some posts to sensitize the population to make that to ask the president to make his resignation. So it is impossible for the constitutional court.
Niaga, now that you understand that it will be impossible to demand the resignation of the president, what will you do next as a young opposition leader? What will you do next? What are you telling your supporters?
So today we ask for the resignation of the president. We give him an ultimatum. The ultimatum was until 18 o'clock. So after this ultimatum, some protesters moving to Sebeniko, where the president is living. So there is some of the policemen stop them. But I'm sure now the political leaders as Mamu Diko and Shogel Kokalamaya, they're going to make some analysis or some reflection to find the next step. The next step normally is to organize another protestation, maybe next Friday or all the days. This is the possibility. So next Friday or every day.
Niaga, so let me ask you. We heard late Friday that French forces have killed Al-Qaeda's North Africa chief, Abdelmalek Doudkel, in northern Mali. What is your reaction to that?
Officially, we didn't. This action can't change anything to our determination. This is a good news. We can take that, but I'm not sure this action can change anything to our commitment now. So maybe this action is just, it can't change anything.
Yeah, some Malians are saying that because of his presence, there's insecurity in Mali. So the fact that he has been taken off and it will no longer be a threat to Mali and other surrounding countries, that's a good development. Wouldn't this impact on the security that you express concern about?
Well, firstly, personally, you know, it is not the first time the French forces, armies announced they killed a leader, for terrorist leader. So we have to make sure if this information is true. This is the first. If it is true, I told to you, I'm not sure if this killing is going to change anything in our security now. Maybe, you know, if they kill Beladen, they kill Al-Baghdadi, but the terrorists didn't change degrees.
Niaga Diop is a young Malian political leader. He spoke with me from the capital, Bamako. Hassan Ayariga, leader of the Ghanaian Opposition All People Congress or APC party, says he's sharply against plans by the Electoral Commission to compile a new voter list to be used for the upcoming December elections. The Electoral Commission recently announced plans for a 40-day voter registration period to compile the new list. But opposition and civil society groups reject the plan, saying the process will disenfranchise many prospective voters, an accusation the Electoral Commission rejects. Hassan Ayariga tells me the Electoral Commission's insistence on compiling a new voter list is a waste of taxpayers' money and will undermine the country's burgeoning democratic credentials.
We believe that it is not feasible technically. Legally, it's not possible to compile a voter list 5 months to election. And we think that government needs to listen to the people. Government needs to understand that as a nation, the most important thing is for us to defend our constitution in a manner that is acceptable, in a manner that is debatable, and in a manner that we must all understand each other. If we do, we probably might have an entrenched position with regard to the compilation of a voter register. In Article 45A of our Constitution, it gives the Electoral Commission the mandate to compile a voter register. And let me read Article 45A to you. 45A says that to compile a voter register, revise it as and when it is necessary, determined by law. Here, in our case, we do have a voter register. So what we need to do is to revise the voter register if we have issues.
But Dr. Yariga, the Electoral Commission is of the view that the current voter register as it exists now is fraught with inconsistencies and fraud. So there is more for a new transparent and credible one. Don't you want a transparent and credible electoral register to be used by Ghanaians to choose their next leader?
In the last election, we used this register to elect two presidents. Now, in the last IFAC meeting, which I was part of, I asked the Electoral Commission a simple question. And that question was whether the current voter register is credible or not. The Electoral Commission could not answer the question of whether our current voter register is credible or not. So if you cannot answer a question of whether the current voter register is credible or not, why then do you need a new register? You must be able to answer that question. And the meeting has to be disrupted. Because in any case, if you cannot answer a simple question of the credibility of the register, then you don't need a new register. Now, the Electoral Commission is saying that the current voter register is overbloated with names of dead people. So that is not enough excuse for anybody to call for a new voter register.
Now, Dr. Ayari, let me ask you this question. Now, supporters of the ruling party are of the view that there has to be a new voter register. Your party, as an opposition party, has kicked against it. You are at an extreme position. Some Ghanaians are saying the fact that the Electoral Commission is adamant or insisting that there should be a new register shows it's a true independence. And that is what they need to ensure that the upcoming election is free, fair, transparent, and credible. Why don't you like that?
That is why I'm telling you that we already have a credible voter register. The Electoral Commission cannot argue with the fact that the current voter register is not credible. That same register was used to produce President John Dramani Mahama. That same register was used to elect President Nana Akufo-Addo. That same register was used to elect unit committee members. That same register was used to create readings. And the error margin was 0.6%. The last thing we used for was the unit committee election. In that election, we had an error of 0.6. And the Electoral Commission is telling the news that because of an error of 0.6, they believe that we can have a perfect register. Let me tell you, no register in this world is 100% correct. There is some level of error, whether in the U.S., in Ghana, in any African country, or in any of the European countries. You will definitely have an error margin there.
What is the way forward to resolve this on path? Because the Electoral Commission is determined for a new register.
The Electoral Committee is determined because they want to disenfranchise a lot of Ghanaians. Not because they want a voter register. Not because the current register is not credible. Not because the current register is overbloated. They have a different reason for asking for a new voter register. If you think that you need a voter register because you believe that the data in that register is corrupted, what do? We use the biometric system of registering people. So if you have a biometric voter register and you are asking government to give you an opportunity to bring in a facial recognition, what is the facial recognition going to add up that is much better than what we have at the biometric fingerprint?
Let me ask you this. Both your party and other opposition parties, as well as civil society groups, are expressing concern about what you are describing as the plan to disenfranchise Ghanaians. People are asking for the proof of that because they say that if there's an enhancement, it should benefit all Ghanaians.
In Ghana here, we have 16 widgets, and the Electoral Commission has sent a CI 91 to Parliament to give them the opportunity to use the Ghana Pass as a basis of registration and the Ghana card, which is called the NIA card, as the basis of identifying a Ghanaian and registering a Ghanaian to vote. So if you say such an instrument or such a document should be used to register 16 regions over 18 million Ghanaians, how do you expect people who live in various regions who cannot have access to passport get a passport? How do you expect that? That is number one. A passport in Ghana, it's 100 Ghana cedis. 100 Ghana cedis is a lot of money for people living in remote areas and in areas where there are a lot of unemployment and jobless people.
Hassan Ayariga is the leader of the Ghanaian Opposition All People Congress, or APC, party. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Christian groups in The Gambia have expressed concern that a new draft constitution currently being considered
will not protect their right to worship. They want provisions in the previous constitution which ensure their protection to be maintained. They fear the new draft will subject them to the Sharia law, which is mostly observed by Muslims in the West African country. Christians are a minority group in the Gambia, with its dominant religion being Islam. Moses Sonko, pastor of the Prevailing in Christ Ministries, is a leading member of the Christian group calling for protections for minority groups in the new draft. He tells me that a majority of citizens want the Gambia to remain a secular country where different religions can peacefully coexist.
Not just the Christian groups, but also minorities and even Muslims are concerned about the new content and provisions in the draft constitution. One of the number one concerns that has always been my concern is the departure from the mandate that was given to them by the CRC, which is the Constitutional Review Commission. Amongst their mandate was to maintain the secular nature of the country. They should safeguard that to make sure that it continues. Not necessarily to put in the word secular, but to maintain the secular nature. But what we see primarily in this new constitution is a complete opposite. I think the CRC made sure that they maintain and saw the amplification and strengthening of Sharia in this new constitution.
What do you say to the Gambians who are of the opinion that the Sharia law as in this draft constitution will not impact negatively on Christians because you don't practice that religion, and that you have a set of rules in the English kind of system adopted by the Gambia, so you should not be worried or will not be impacted negatively by the practice of the Sharia in the new draft constitution?
Well, what I'll say to them is the fact that in our 1997 constitution, the language that was there was much stronger than the language that is in this proposed draft constitution. In the previous constitution, 97 constitution, which we are currently using, it says clearly that the Sharia law applies only to Muslims and those who practice the Muslim faith. That's what is said explicitly in the 97 constitution. But in this new draft constitution, it refuses to use that word only Muslim. It says it applies to Muslims and any related parties. So in that case, we're talking about those that are married to Muslims or Muslim converts.
What will minority religions, or for that matter, Christian groups, want to see in this new draft constitution that you think will give you adequate protections?
First and foremost, we'll want them to follow the mandate that was given to them and bring Sharia back down to the level where it was. They've changed it from Qadi court to Sharia court, which is fine. But on top of that, they added Sharia appeals court and Sharia high courts with Sharia judges in our high courts. So we're saying bring that down, one. And number two, if Sharia is going to be in the way it is, that it should be clearly stated in the constitution that it applies only to Muslims. We want them to use those words, that Sharia applies only to Muslims.
How are you going to engage these drafters of this new constitution to have your voices heard and to address your concerns so you are not taken by surprise if the whole measure goes into effect after approval by the executive?
Actually, the executive have already approved it, so now it's in the parliament and they're supposed to be debating on it. So our approach is to convince and explain to our members of parliament our concerns and our fears, and after which, if all fails, then after the parliament it goes to referendum. That's the only place. And then after, if we cannot convince our members of parliament, we have to take it to the streets and take it to the air and explain to the people really the dangers of this draft constitution. It looks okay on the surface, but there are a lot of hidden agenda in it. You know, for example, this Sharia that we're talking about, the question is, what version of Sharia is being applied, is being talked about?
What do you think are the prospects that you will succeed in your
endeavor, particularly when you have an overwhelming majority Muslim population in the Gambia?
Yeah, we are very optimistic that we will, our point or our voice will be heard. You know, because even though Gambia is a majority Muslim, but a lot of them don't want Sharia or the influence of Sharia in this country. And a lot of them is because of ignorance. But I believe if we start educating them about what is to come, they will wake up and smell the coffee, and they will either force members of parliament to change those provisions. Another thing also is the fact that we have to make them understand that the Sharia part of our constitution, there are clauses that are entrenched. And in the law part of our constitution, they are not entrenched.
Moses Sonko is the pastor of the Prevailing in Christ Ministries. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. In Tanzania, the main opposition party, Chadema, plans to form an alliance with other opposition groups ahead of the upcoming October general election. The opposition party says it aims to form a robust group capable of wresting power from incumbent President John Magufuli. The party accuses the president and his government of violating the constitution by using state institutions, including the police, to silence dissent, as well as intimidate and harass opponents. Supporters of the governing Chama cha Mapinduzi or CCM party reject the accusation as without merit. John Mrema is Chadema's Director of Communications, Foreign Affairs and Protocols. He tells me that the main opposition party will only form an alliance with the opposition groups that demonstrate seriousness and the resolve to defeat the president in the polls.
Yes, it is very true that we have called other opposition political parties to join forces so that we can form a strong coalition for the coming general election so that we can defeat President Magufuli and his party. And we've decided to do that because we know for sure that without a strong coalition from all political opposition as well as civil society and every stakeholder in this election, we can't defeat him. So we have opened up our doors, whatever, so that we can be together between us and all well-wishers of Tanzanian democracy so that we can form a very strong alliance, because we can't afford another 5 years with no democracy, with no human rights and whatsoever.
Now, John, let me ask you this. What has been the response of the other political parties that you've opened your doors to? How enthusiastic are they to join this plan to form a strong coalition as you described?
As you are speaking right now, after the announcement 2 days ago, ACT Wazalendo have called us and that they are ready for the coalition. But also other opposition political parties, they have said that they are ready. But what we say is that we will form a coalition with a serious opposition political parties who are ready to remove CCM from power, and not all the political opposition, because we know some of them, they are stooges of the ruling party. So that's why we said we need to form a coalition with serious opposition political parties. And I'm sure that we have formed a committee. On our party, I'm a member of that committee of building a coalition, but also I'm the secretary of that committee from the party. We will talk to other serious opposition political parties on how to form this alliance and how to go about the coming general election of October this year.
How confident are you about the prospect of winning political power, particularly when the Chama cha Mapinduzi or the ruling party has been dominant in winning elections in Tanzania since its independence with regards to founding President Julius Mwalimu Nyerere?
We are very confident at this time because for the first time, we have the opportunity of that, because even the ruling party, CCM, they are divided. They are not sure if they will give Magufuli another 5 more years, they will be safe. Last general election, we had 39.8% of the presidential votes, and we only need to increase that percent only by 12%. And we are confident because we are now having a new generation, people who are going to vote for the first time in their lives. 7 million have been registered. And these 7 million youths are the ones who have been deprived from the freedom of association. They have been deprived from their freedom of getting jobs. we are confident that we have an agenda for them. That's why they should vote for us. That's why we are confident. That if the matter is, we have to file a candidate who the public needs, and we are sure can offer that alternative.
Now, so let me ask you this question. What plans will Chadema put in place in order to address or anticipate possible concerns of friction if there is an alliance? Because in Africa, there have been alliances formed, and then because of what some people describe as parochial interests, the objective for which the alliances are formed are misplaced or are not being achieved. What is uniquely different about this plan Chadema is putting into place?
We have learned a lesson since 2016 general election, and we have a very specific plan. We have formed a team that will lead our negotiation team between us and the other opposition political parties. We are confident that we are going to form a strong coalition with serious opposition political parties on this matter. And what we are going to do that, different is that we have to agree on the merits. Who is going to be the candidate and why? What portion do we have? What are we going to share when we are forming the government? These are the things we are going to discuss very early before even forming a coalition. On the side of Zanzibar, we are sure that if we form a coalition, and as CCM divided as they are today, we are going to win as well as on the side of the Zanzibar. And on the mainland, we are sure people are tired, religious leaders are tired, every person in the community are tired, media personnel are tired, people, they need back their freedom. So because people need their freedom, we are confident that this agenda of freedom, it is what Mwalimu Nyerere did during the colonial era.
John Mrema is Chadema's Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, a prominent Burundian civil society leader says the ruling of the Constitution Court upholding the electoral victory of the ruling party's presidential candidate is not a true reflection of the situation on the ground. Vital Nshimirimana, leader of the group Forum for the Strengthening of Civil Society, says it appears the court disregarded evidence of clear voter irregularities and rigging during the recent general election. His remarks come after the court upheld the election of Evariste Ndayishimiye, presidential candidate for the ruling CNDD-FDD party. It also dismissed the petition of the main opposition leader contesting the outcome of the May 20 polls. The judges said his petition was null and void. Vital Nshimirimana tells me there is need for supporters of the opposition to remain peaceful in spite of what he says is provocation by members of the governing CNDD-FDD party.
Well, everybody has taken notice of the ruling of the Constitutional Court about the case filed by the opposition CNL party. Yet, we don't believe that it reflects what should be taken as just and equitable.
But Vital, why do you think the ruling is not a true reflection of what happened during the elections?
Well, there is very many things which happened during the elections. One, the observers who were deployed on the ground observed a number of irregularities, and the Catholic Church bishops group also observed the same, and the opposition of CNL claimed victory as it criticized the opacity of the process, and they said that there have been the elections were marred with a lot of irregularities. And what was very surprising is that the National Commission in charge of elections proclaimed the results on 25 But 2 days later, it is said that all the results that it declared were just a draft, that they were not true. So a case was filed in taking into consideration the results proclaimed on the 25, meaning the court has decided taking into consideration the results of 25. But because yet we are to see the ruling, we are to read the ruling, we do not know exactly what the court said exactly about all those arguments.
Vital, I understand where you're coming from. Even the Catholic bishops raised doubt about the result after it observers witnessed instances of multiple voting, among other issues raised. But the court said Agathon Rwasa's appeal was unfounded and that its ruling basically would have to be accepted. Now, if this is accepted, that means Agathon Rwasa will remain opposition leader and not a president, as his own tabulation shows that he won the election. What avenues does he have to challenge anything anymore?
No, he has nothing to do so far. In the recent past, many cases were filed with the East African Court of Justice, but so far we have seen that the East African Court of Justice itself has changed a lot. It has changed tremendously because we do believe that even the regional court is dominated by the politicians.
So, Vital, what will you expect from opposition supporters after what they have been describing as an injustice at the court, which they said shows the court doesn't have independence to look at its evidence presented to them in order to adjudicate or rule in their favor? What do you expect them to do in this prevailing conditions in Burundi?
What we expect from them is to remain peaceful and deal with their dairy business. But what we fear is the provocation from the so-called winner ruling party, the CNDD-FDD, whose Imbonerakure young wing always provoke those who do not believe or support the CNDD-FDD regime. This is what we fear.
So what do you say to President-elect Evariste Ndayishimiye following his election as the next president of Burundi? What are your expectations? Do you expect an improved human rights record? Do you expect corruption to be weeded out as he promised? What do you expect?
Well, he has been supported, backed by the ruling party, the CNDD-FDD ruling party, and the military junta, which is actually leading Burundi. But what we expect is that he may be different from Nkurunziza, or make difference from his surrounding environment, so that if he makes that happen, to be able to free from that surrounding environment and be able to think about uniting and reconciliating the people of Burundi, then that's what we expect, that's what we hope. If not, Burundi will remain under the dictatorship of the junta, and more lives will be lost.
Vital Nshimirimana is the leader of the Forum for the Strengthening of Civil Society, a Burundian civil society group. He spoke with me from Brussels, Belgium. The Ugandan Prime Minister has become the country's first high-ranking official to go into isolation after being exposed to COVID-19. This comes as Uganda embarks on a mandatory testing of all ministers following confirmation of coronavirus cases in the Prime Minister's office. The Health Ministry says the decision to test ministers was made after they were identified as a high-risk group.
VOA Catherine Nambi reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda tweeted confirmation that he was going into self-isolation after some of his contacts tested positive to COVID-19. The Prime Minister says he has tested negative, but the isolation is in line with health guidelines. According to health regulations, the Prime Minister is to remain in isolation for 14 days, during which he will be tested again and observed for COVID-19 related symptoms. Rugunda, as the head of Uganda's anti-COVID-19 National Task Force, has been leading a team of government officials tasked with combating the epidemic. It still remains unclear whether the Prime Minister's contacts were ministers. His action has coincided with ongoing testing of ministers for COVID-19. Emmanuel Ainebiona is the Minister of Health spokesperson.
And this is going to be done regularly every after 2 weeks. And this is to ensure that members of cabinet are safe. And also because from time to time they are moving from one place to another, supervise government activities and programs.
Ainebiona says a number of high-risk groups will also be subjected to testing as measure to fight COVID-19 in Uganda.
The incident management team will continuously identify groups of people that will be tested. For instance, we've already tested some of the journalists who have been active recovering the response. The Ministry of Health staff have also been tested.
The Ministry of Health in Uganda announced on Sunday that 7 of its frontline workers have tested positive for COVID-19. The confirmed cases included 3 nurses, 2 doctors, and 2 senior level staff. With 557 cases, Uganda currently has the third highest number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the East African region. Kenya has the highest at 2,340, followed by South Sudan with 994. Tanzania has 509 and Rwanda 410. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The United Nations Human Rights Office reports around 1,300 civilians have been killed in Democratic Republic of Congo conflict over the past 8 months. It says some killings may amount to crimes against humanity or war crimes. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Separate conflicts in Congo's volatile Ituri, North Kivu, and South Kivu provinces have escalated in recent weeks. The UN Human Rights Office reports armed groups have committed massacres and other atrocities with disastrous results for the civilian population. The agency also holds government, defense, and security forces responsible for grave human rights violations in these eastern provinces as well as other parts of the country. There has been no response from the government. In January, the UN published a searing report about inter-ethnic violence in Ituri province. The UN accused Lendu armed groups of slaughtering mainly members of the ethnic Hema, but also the Alor, to control the natural resources in the region. It said the systematic brutality of these acts might constitute crimes against humanity. Liz Throssell is spokeswoman for Michelle Bachelet, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She says the CODECO, an armed group comprising mainly Lendu fighters, continues to brutalize the Hema and other communities.
The High Commissioner said that so far, to their credit, the targeted communities have refrained from retaliating. And what she's saying is that in the absence of effective protection by state security forces, there is a serious risk that these communities will feel compelled to form self-defense groups, which would most likely exacerbate an already dire situation.
In North Kivu province, government forces launched military operations against local armed groups in November 2019. These led to retaliatory attacks against civilians. Throssell says conditions in the province remain desperate, with fighting between state defense forces and armed groups causing many civilian deaths and large-scale displacement. She says the High Commissioner is calling on the Congolese authorities to do the utmost to protect civilians from being victimized by both armed groups and security forces in Ituri and North Kivu.
Protection of civilians is the responsibility of the state, and when the state leaves a vacuum, others tend to fill it. In DRC, past experience shows this can have catastrophic results. The generalised and systematic nature of some of the attacks on civilians in both Ituri and North Kivu may amount to crimes against humanity and war crimes.
The clash has worsened already dire conditions in parts of Ituri and North Kivu, where the UN Refugee Agency estimates that more than 2.5 million Congolese are displaced from their homes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Sock, 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 sock Oh, yeah. Tonight. Oh, tonight. Baby, please give me
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Said Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, not everyone who chased the zebra caught it, but he who caught it chased it. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.